Welcome to Model Rail Radio. I'm Tom Barbelay, and this is being recorded live on Skype, April 26, 2014. Model Rail Radio is the internet's only live recorded radio show where the topic is the hobby of model railroading. We'll set up a UK-European friendly time, and of course we have on the one and only Andy Dixon. Andy, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, very well, Tom, thank you.
So I've been admiring your benchwork on Facebook recently, and your benchwork is just absolutely phenomenal. Now, I'm no benchwork expert. I just look at it associated with the rigidity, and perhaps probably, you know, some benchwork traditionalists might say that you were slightly over-engineering the benchwork, but I actually like it. I like it a lot. Can you talk a little bit about your benchwork philosophy?
Well, I have heard that I'm over-engineering it, and I probably am, but in my head, before I even started, I wanted benchwork that was rock solid, that I could climb on if I needed to. I shouldn't have to, but it is rock solid, and I don't want anything to move it. My aisles aren't particularly wide, and the chances are that I will bump into them frequently. So, if it's solid, it's not going to go anywhere. Anything that's on there, it's not going to hurt. So that's really where I'm at.
And the benchwork, I don't even know what the technical term would be. I would use the term stringer, but it's probably the wrong term. The thin benchwork that goes past the windows that you've posted most recently on Facebook. You could stand on that as well. That's a pretty hefty benchwork for just probably a piece of track beside the window. Or is actually that just going to be elevated track that's going to work its way down through a mountain or something to the benchwork below?
No, it's just a stringer or whatever it is across the window. It is that, that large, although it's certainly the timber I used there wasn't as substantial as the rest that I've used. I've used thinner across the window, mainly because it's such a span. I think it's 6-7 foot, something like that. If I used thinner wood or a lighter construction, it would bow in the middle, yes, which I didn't want. So it is really just linking the section from round the workbench to the section on the other wall. So there is no level change between the tiers. Each tier stays on its own, as it were.
And returning to your, well, I won't say your original plan, I'll say your last stated plan on Model Rail Radio. Yeah. Is your plan still the same? Or more importantly, maybe you should restate what your current plan is for the layout room, because it certainly seems that you're sticking with at least possibly the multi-region, multi-level elements. Have you changed your view at all associated with the layout room?
I hope I haven't. I'm wavering on one section. My plan still is for the UK in the first level, the second level being US, and the top level on the peninsula alone will be Swiss, because then I can come round in multiple passes of the same place. So it'll basically climb. It won't come back down. It'll just go up to a higher station. But if you go north from Philosur, say, in Switzerland, you'll go through the Albula Pass and the spiral tunnels and that area. That's what I'm looking at. Mm. So there's all sorts of opportunities for it to come in and out and basically just generally climb. And then it still is at the moment, still Japanese on the rest of the top tier on the, around the walls. Mm. But I'm now thinking, should I really carry on with that for the minute and maybe use that top shelf for some of the 00 stuff that I have?
Mm. Yes, your uncle gave you a real problem when he passed on the 00 stuff.
And if you remember when I first came on, I told you about my Uncle Derek that first inspired me when I was a young boy. He died probably 15 years ago, and his wife also died a few years back. But this week, I was contacted by his eldest daughter, who inherited the house, and she's due to be moving, and she's doing the house up. But when Derek died, they auctioned off all his locos,
mm-hmm.
apparently. I have no idea what they went for in the end, but they clearly didn't sell all of his stuff. Apparently, according to Susan, there is what she calls a treasure trove still in the house. And would I like it? This includes some rolling stock, I believe, some structures that he's built, some stuff that he's built himself, some planes, tanks.
Gosh.
I've no idea. Magazines, books.
Gosh.
I could end up with another. I don't know yet, to be fair.
So I think the trick is partially to be born into the right family in order to have access to this kind of stuff. But yeah, for folks who may have uncles and, other folk that have inherited model rail related stuff, how do you get the reputation in the family to be the fellow that comes and cleans out all this stuff at some level? Because you must have that reputation, and it must kind of permeate through your family that you're the guy to remove all this modelling related stuff.
Well, Uncle Ron that gave me all the stuff at Christmas, he knew that I was into railways. But Susan, I mean, her and her sister are friends on Facebook. I mean, I've still stayed in contact with them. So they're not actually family. They're just a family that lived over the road from Uncle Ron when he lived in London.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
And he's like an adopted uncle, really.
Oh, okay.
Or he was. But I've kept in contact with his daughters, and Sarah, the younger one, has seen pictures that I've posted of some structures and some models that I've put on here.
Mm.
And I think she's seen them and then told her sister, and she said, I'd no idea that you were still into the railways, and would you like this stuff? It's like, yes, please.
Yeah, no, it sounds socially irresponsible to do the top level in Japanese theme now. It sounds like
I don't think I can get away with not doing it, to be fair.
And also, if he's got structures and things, I mean, I know the hobby has changed quite a bit in the past, 20, 30 odd years.
Mm-hmm.
But if he's got structures, I mean, I guess you can make this assessment when you actually receive the treasure trove and, in quotation marks. It may be worth actually doing one of the lower levels. I mean, one of the ones that has more substantial space. You could be treading into dangerous waters here, Annie. I'm please do update the Facebook group with photos. You don't get down to London frequently though, so I'm assuming, is this going to be a special trip or is it just going to be when you're in the area?
Well, she's doing the house up. She wants to decorate before she can get it on the market, and she wants to do that in the next couple of months. So she tells me. And she's still finding stuff as she goes along. Once she's found it all, I think there's stuff in the loft, under the stairs. I've no idea where it is. She'll let me know. I can either go down and pick it up, which if I needed to, I would do a special trip just for it.
Yes.
Or she could curry it to me. So we'll wait and see how much there is, really, I think.
Yeah, the volume is really the key question if you're heading down. I was quite impressed by the amount that you could take at Christmas time of your uncle's stuff. But I'm not sure.
I still have a large estate car, so that's not so bad.
Yes. Well, is that from when you were a musician? Is that dating back to when you were a musician, your estate car, or is it just something that you've kind of maintained?
No, unfortunately, I don't think I'll ever get away from having an estate car. I always did have one when I was a musician. Okay. It was that or a van.
Yes.
But now it's more the dog.
Mm.
So we've permanently got a dog cage in the back of the car. So if I would, for instance, I have to unload all the dog stuff.
Yes.
Put the seats down, get the wood, then put dog stuff back in.
Yeah. Well, it's also good for your wood addiction as well. I mean, your wood addiction is, very useful to have an estate car because you can take that extra volume.
Yeah. Well, that is certainly useful. I mean, I bought some. Funnily enough, bought some timber today.
Fancy that.
No, I did set out. I mean, my wife came up with this brilliant idea that I should cut a hole in the door to the railway room.
Yes, and turn it
a ticket office door.
No, that's beautiful. So, I think that works wonderfully.
I hope it will. I mean, I there's still some sort of figuring out. I went to get some trim today. I've got some framing so I can strengthen the door. And then we'll figure out exactly how I'm going to do it. I'll try and do it the best I can.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it was completely her idea. In fact, she'd mentioned it probably a month ago, and I said, well, yeah, I'll get round to it because I've been busy building this, that, and the other.
Mm-hmm.
And yesterday we'd been to Chester, mm-hmm. and we were sat having a cup of tea. She said, well, get on with it. You can go and cut a hole in the door now. Okay. So I did.
Yeah, it works on a number of levels, because as you continue to build the room out, where basically soon it will be only an opportunity for maybe you and one other to stand in the room, the window door gives the opportunity for the outside world to actually look into your fantasy world.
That was exactly her thinking.
Very interesting. So I've got one last question, because we do have a number of folk on the call. When are you going to be done with the bench work?
Ooh, good question. My son goes back to school on Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
I've still got the woodwork left to do in my kitchen, finishing that decorating. Then I move on to his bedroom.
Mm.
I'm trying to get that's the last room I'm actually going to be decorating until after the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And then that only leaves the dining room and lounge, and hopefully, fingers crossed, that's the house finished.
Mm.
Apart from the outside, which hopefully will be this summer.
Yeah, I'm living that life too. So, I appreciate all of that.
I know. So I've got what I've got left to build is the second and third tiers staging.
Mm.
Which, as you come in the room, which is the wall on the right hand side, and each one's probably 11 foot by mm-hmm. no more than a foot wide.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's not, I mean, if I could, I mean, chances are I could have that done by the end of the week, but then I've got the issue of putting the deck on each of these,
yep.
on these tiers. I've got the sub row bed to build for mm-hmm. the spirals on the Swiss section. I've got the fascia that I'm putting on. I've got some flexible MDF, which I've been using to round the corners. So I can, within a month, I hopefully, fingers crossed, have all the bench work finished.
Mm.
And then I can start thinking about laying some track and making it look like a railway rather than a big, huge pile of wood.
Andy, I really, really enjoy your Facebook photo updates. I'm very impressed with what you've been able to do in a relatively short amount of time. And it's always a pleasure chatting with you. Please do stay on the line. And if anything comes up that piques your interest, please do get back on the call. But always a pleasure chatting.
Excellent. Thank you, Tom.
I'd like to welcome on Jimmy Lowe, and before I begin asking the standard Model Rail Radio question, the reason that we're recording this morning is because of Jimmy Lowe. Jimmy,
thank you very much.
A very active member of the Facebook group, and insisted that we have a morning show so he could come on and talk about his model railroading hobby. I like to hear that from a listener and a participant of the Facebook group. Jimmy, please introduce your model railroading interests.
Thank you very much, Tom, and good morning, everybody, and thank you for spending your Saturday morning, I believe, on the show with me. Let me introduce myself, Jimmy Lowe from Malaysia, Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. And I believe, Tom, you have been to Kuala Lumpur.
Some of the highlights of my later teenage life were in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. We'll talk about that in a minute. But introduce your model railroading interests.
Well, I'm interested in N scale, definitely, if you can see from my Facebook and from my blogs.
Yes.
The reason why I chose N scale and I'm pushing a lot of people to go for N scale, especially those in Malaysia, is because I think it's a very nice and comfortable scale, given that the space that we have in Malaysia, we don't have a lot of space.
Certainly.
Myself, I don't have a lot of space. And I find that N is very suitable scale for me. I live in Kuala Lumpur for 35 years before I moved to Germany 5 years ago.
Mm.
And basically, I was living in the shop house where my grandparent had a shop house. And, as an Asian family, you have all the uncles and aunties
Certainly.
Living
yes.
together and cousins together. And,
yes.
you don't have space. And when
what
I got
was
my own...
the nature of the shop, Jimmy? What kind of business was conducted in the shop?
Family businesses, we make noodles.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, the raw noodles.
Mm.
You find them a lot in the Chinese restaurants, in the Indian restaurants. I'm very sure you have enjoyed some of those noodles.
Fond memories.
Not the instant noodles. These are serious noodles.
Yes.
Hard labor, hard work in the morning to produce them and to supply them to the schools and restaurants and canteens. So then I got my own house, married in 2002, and I got my own house in 2007. We decided to do my MBA in Germany. Mm-hmm. That's how I got myself here in Germany. And as a result, although I have dedicated a 11 by 12 feet room in my old place in Kuala Lumpur, but didn't get a chance to build it. I have all the track plans, all the calculations done. Everything ready, but building it. So I didn't have a chance to build it. And when I moved here to Germany, again, space was an issue.
Certainly.
I was negotiating with my wife whether do I get a bigger space for my train room. Unfortunately, not. I started planning for a tutable layout table.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So was looking for some plans in the internet and found one or two person in USA who was building this tutable layout.
Certainly.
Got all the plans, measurements all done up, even looked for the right type of wood and everything. And my wife says, nope, you're not getting the space because we are reworking the whole apartment.
Yes.
And
I've been there too, Jimmy. I know how that is. I've been there as well.
And in the end, I've got a balcony, which is 4 meter by 1.6 meter.
Mm.
And I think that is just the right size for one person to manage the whole layout.
Yes.
And I'm still building. In fact, I've got the, it consists of 8 modules altogether.
Gosh.
So I've made it modular in such a way that, I could take it out anytime I needed to clean the windows and clean the place.
Certainly.
So, so I have 6 standard modules and 2 end modules. So make up about, the equivalent area space of the tiltable layout. So I get what I want in tiltable layout, but in a modular format and around the balcony.
So you cover a number of areas that interest me. Yeah. And I'm trying to think of the order that I should approach these questions in, but I'm going to start with the most obvious one. You are now in Germany.
Yes, I am.
There's a lot of really interesting model rail related stuff in Germany. Do you belong to a local club, or have you been able to connect with the German model railroaders in your area?
I managed to connect to one called the Endbahner Rhein-Main.
Mm-hmm.
The founder, Armin Marquardt, I think he's also part of the model rail radio. And yeah.
Maybe, yeah.
I've got involved with him in a sense that got his advice and help. I've got connected with one club called NCI in Stuttgart. They are truly the modular club.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, other than that, I've not been really active going around to the clubs because, around my area, I haven't found any that is really nearby. And, at this moment, I'm focusing on just building my layout first, getting help online as and when I can from the Facebook groups, both from the model rail radio as well as from the German forums.
So your layout is set in Germany?
Yes. It is called somewhere in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is to pick certain points in Germany and to model them as a representation of that part of that railway in my model. So I do not have a specific concept in mind. So I can say it's more like a freelance siding towards prototypical layout.
Mm.
So I'm looking at pictures, going around museums, visiting various places to get some ideas and see how German railway looks like, the sceneries, the surroundings, and try to put them into my model layout.
So what themes are you tracking through your layout? Because there's a lot in Germany, a lot of possibilities. What have you distilled it down into?
Okay, I'm focusing in the late summer, early spring season.
Certainly.
I think this is a beautiful time where you have big greenery and as the leaves start to turn brown and yellow and colorful. So I think that was a beautiful scene. And I've seen some of pictures from those in Canada and US.
Mm-hmm.
There's just magnificent colors. There's That's one I'm focusing on. The other one I'm focusing more towards era 5 and era 6. So the more modern era, where you have a more modern diesel, the ICEs, and where you have a combination of foreign railway operators running on German railways. So I'm not really that tied to modeling just Deutsche Bahn per se, but I could bring in OBB, I could bring in the Swiss, I could bring in the French, to run a parallel along on and off on the layout.
So for international listeners, the era numbering convention, I think it's used by Bachmann. I'm not sure if it's used in Germany as well. What specific dates are you talking about here?
So era 5 and 6, we're looking at around 2010 onwards. Or in fact, 2007 and onwards.
Gosh, okay, so very modern.
So it's very modern. So we're looking at modern, that's right. Macklin, in fact, introduced it.
Interesting.
And therefore, it became, I wanted to model something very, very recent, because of the rolling stocks that I'm planning to acquire. Occasionally, I would run a couple of steam trains as to show that there are more like museum trains, special occasions excursion trains. So in fact, recently I went to the called the Eisenbahn Museum in Bochum, which is about 2 weeks ago. And there was a flea market or a trade market, and I got a set of hobby trains, Rheingold 5 wagons with LED lamps, table lamps, and for €50.
Wow.
It's really bargained. And I wanted to collect one Rheingold and managed to find one at that good price, and I said, yes, I must have it. There was a BR-38 also from Hobby Trains, but the engine didn't look quite good, so I decided not to grab the engine together with the set. So I just went for the train set, and I'll get the engine sometime later.
Yeah, in N scale, the steam engine quality is really important. You've got to get a good quality steam engine in N scale, otherwise you're just going to have nothing but problems. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, that's right.
So in terms, I'm assuming you're running a passenger service on your layout from what you describe. What kind of industries are on the layout?
I've not really decided on the industry yet. I'm planning as I go along. I think steel industry will be one interesting industry, and it's a very big industry, or used to be a big industry in Germany. And if you've seen my recent post, I was in Duisburg, Oberhausen, and there used to be a major steel industry in the Rhine-Ruhr area. And I think, it gives me some ideas of modeling some steel industries or the remains of some steel industries on my layout. I've not decided where to put them yet.
They're big industries. That's the problem with the layout as you've described it, is you could probably build 4 modules just for a single steel industry, potentially.
Exactly.
Interesting. Yep. Interesting. So you gave me a slight clue, Jimmy, when you first described your situation associated with the answer to this question, but I have to ask it. You mentioned that you had a room set up in Malaysia that you were going to build a layout in.
That's right.
When you were going to build that layout, what area were you going to build on that layout specifically?
My passion all this while has been the U.S. Rail Class 1 railroad. So, I started reading the Model Railroader magazines when I found it in one of the small bookshop in Malaysia. And that's when I started reading about it, and I started subscribing to it since, I think, about 15 years ago.
Gosh.
I've been reading, but I have not actually put my hands on building one, but more towards thinking and planning about it. So the title of my layout when I first planned at the time was called Rosenberg Mid, and it was focusing on Tower 17 Junction in Texas.
Interesting.
It was this particular picture of a Tower 17 between BNSF, let me try to recall, BNSF Galveston, and UP Gildent subdivision.
Yes.
And it was this beautiful tower that was where this US, the BNSF and the UP intersects.
Yes. Very nice. So real opportunity in N scale to model space
Exactly. That's the reason why I decided to go for ant skill, where you have a good balance of a good balance of real operation plus the scenery.
Yes.
And in fact, I have been so-called, quote-unquote, converting people or friends of modelers from Malaysia into ant skill, because I've been telling them that I think given the space that we have in Malaysian homes, and it seems more practical that we go for ant. And because HO is more available in Malaysia, initially to Toys R Us, those cheap, lifelike starter set. And of course, Maglin is one of the active, sellers or readily available in Malaysia. And now we have Fleischmann and Rocco's, as well as Pico models available in Malaysia. So HO is still, popular or is being seen as a acceptable, starter set for many of them, and to push them to encourage them to to consider that there is another skill called ant.
Yes.
And there is a viable skill that they could adopt and make use of.
So some of my fondest memories of Malaysia related to traveling around Malaysia by train.
Yep.
And Malaysia has some of the most interesting, and I traveled, I wouldn't say frequently, but twice up into Thailand and, you know, crossed over at the border and all this kind of stuff that, you know, you just, the vision of seeing both Malaysia and Thailand, the geography, you can't really appreciate by plane or by car because you just don't get to see it. The freeways are very tree covered and this kind of stuff. But if you travel by train, you get this amazing experience of just the changing geography. The areas are very different into Thailand, but also through Malaysia, the different areas, the steel areas or the mining areas, sorry. And these kind of things are very interesting to see by train. Is there an indigenous model railroading fraternity in Malaysia that builds and models the local trains?
In fact, yes, I would say yes.
Mm-hmm.
There is a group that just started in somewhere beginning of this year.
Mm-hmm.
There's a gathering of about, now we have, I could say, about close to 100 plus modelers.
Very good.
Yeah. In HO scale, of course, and very focused on using what's available, as in from Maglin, from Pico and from Fleischmann as well as Rocco.
Mm-hmm.
However, there are about, there are about three modelers who hand-built their or scratch-built their own Malaysian models.
Wonderful.
Yeah. There's one gentleman by the name of Suhaimi, and he has been modeling for like 30 years. He's built a S-scale on M. So SM scale, I would say we call it as S scale on meter gauge.
Mm.
Yeah. Complete locomotives from even from the beginning.
Mm.
The steam locomotive, the early diesels, the shunting, the shunter locos, coaches, even to the most recent coaches from the Oriental Express. Mm. Just beautiful. Yeah.
The thing about Malaysia in particular is the influence of British steam era locomotives and rolling stock. And something that people don't appreciate, or may not appreciate, listeners may not appreciate, you could probably take a number of UK prototypes and just modify them slightly in order to get the Malaysian aesthetic. And also, there's an interesting mix of locomotives, modern-day locomotives as well in Malaysia, that could just produce some of... Jimmy, if you know these people and they are on Facebook, or if you know people are taking photographs of these layouts, I think the notion of scratch building in S, a Malaysian layout, strikes me as really very interesting. Any additional source material, I know you're no longer in Malaysia, but any additional source material that you can post to the Model Rail Radio Facebook group would really be very heavily appreciated. Because
Go ahead. I'll do that because we have a Facebook group. Mm-hmm. In fact, we have three or four Facebook groups on Malaysian railways.
Wonderful.
We have one website and some the gentleman that makes the S on M gauge models. All his found in the YouTube. Wonderful. So I'll be happy to post them on the Model Rail Radio.
Terrific. So, Jimmy, as you listen to Model Rail Radio, you have very specific interests, very specific needs. Are there any topics that we could be covering that you'd like to hear that you haven't yet heard on Model Rail Radio?
Not in particular. I think this is the first time I'm calling in. I'm interested to hear more from the rest, and I hope that probably every quarter you can organize around the continent kind of chat show. That means we will have one chance of calling in around this time.
Definitely. No, I think you've made a very strong point, Jimmy, and I'm going to definitely do that in the future, if nothing more, to get updates from you.
Yep. Thank you very much.
A pleasure chatting, Jimmy. Please do stay on the call, and if anything comes up, please do jump back in. Good chat.
I'll do that. Thanks.
I'd like to welcome back on Will Merrill. Will, what has been going on in your model railroading hobby since you last called into Model Rail Radio?
In some ways, not a lot. You know, we're in the Philadelphia area, and we've had a brutal winter.
Yes.
And we're just getting the springtime coming in, so we're, you know, it's getting a little easier to get together and stuff. But we've been I'm a member of an N-Track club, so we that's our main focus. And we so we've been working to get our clubhouse layout up and running in better condition. Certainly. There's always things, but we've been adding some new scenery and stuff. So things are in pretty good shape at this point.
I recall you guys are very active, associated with the local shows. How does that work out in the summertime? Are there more shows? Are there less shows? Is this really your prepping time for the kind of fall and winter season of shows? How does that work out?
Well, we seem to have kind of a steady flow all through the year. Our main time is in the, you know, is in the early winter around November, December. You know, in December, we've probably got, you know, four or five shows in December alone.
Yes.
So that's our busiest time by far. You know, so November and December, well, actually September through December is pretty busy. summer, of course, is a little lighter. But we do have shows. That's a time when people, many of us often go off to, bigger shows. You know, we've got, you know, there's a Syracuse show that several of our members go to. There's an Edison show. There's a Timonium show. And so our members are often, visiting some of those.
So you get up, your crew gets up to Syracuse.
We often have one or two members who go up there. We don't usually, well, we certainly don't go there as a club. Okay. We don't have a.
Oh, okay. So it's just folks going up as individuals, not something, not a place you show, for example.
Not as an official club function, because, the distance is far enough that many people can't really make it easily.
Certainly.
But we, do go to a number of shows like that in the area. So, but in our more local area, we're pretty active. All told, we probably do 15 to 20, 25 shows in a year.
Gosh.
So, and, you know, and a lot of those are in the fall, of course.
Yeah.
You know, so we've had, at least two shows this year. We had one in February, one in April.
Yeah.
And then, we got another one coming up in May. So we have a number of shows.
Well, I think the answer to this question is planning, but I'm going to ask this anyway. How do you keep your, if you're going to so many shows and so many people are seeing your, you know, your layout, how do you keep it fresh over this period of time?
Well, of course, we're a modular club.
Certainly.
So in a certain sense, we never show the same layout twice. although there are ways that our, modules fit together better than others. So we, you know, there are certain, you know, there are modules that run well next to the end loops and things like that. So we, there are some things that are common, but, And we always, there are people, we know there are people out there who come to these shows to see us. And they, I think some of them like to see the familiar stuff. And we've had people who come and, you know, introduce, you know, we hear the comments like, over here, these are the guys we were talking, you know, telling you about.
Oh, very good.
You know, so we are sort of known. And very I think good. There are some of the shows that we go to that, people expect to see us at.
So in terms of the modules, I mean, you're obviously surveying your audience very well if you're getting those kind of comments. In terms of the modules, are the favorite modules that you know you need to display at every show? And if so, what are those modules? Well, what do they feature?
About half the modules we show are owned by the club. Hmm. And so they go to most shows. Hmm. A lot of those are things like we have a yard. We have about a, you know, we have two modules that make up a six, you know, there's 6 foot modules each and they make up a 12 foot yard or they can operate independently depending on the amount of size we have. Mm. You know, so those go to every show. We don't do the older style of, you know, big square box, kind of layout because frankly, we're getting old and we don't like to duck under the silly thing.
Certainly.
So we developed a pair of end loops, and we've been using end loops for many years. So all of our layouts wind up being a loop-to-loop format. Mm. So the end loops are they're owned by the club and several of the corners and a couple of intermediate pieces. So those come to most shows. Mm. At this point, the club itself has been around for at least 20 years, in various forms. Although I'm not sure, I think there's only a couple of members that could, that have been there the whole time.
Will, I'm going to rephrase the question I asked because I think while yards and end loops are probably very exciting for your club, for the thing I found here, I travel with my wife occasionally to local train shows and she particularly likes the N-scale module groups. But the sections of the layout that typically draw her attention and oftentimes will draw other people's attention as well are the little kind of vignette sections of layouts, like a town scene or maybe a look into someone's backyard or maybe like a large vegetable garden, or there's a local layout that has an ice skating scene on a section of their module where the people are moving around. I understand your particular passion associated with yards and, you know, the end bits that loop back. But do you get a sense of, like, certain sections of the modules where people gravitate to, where at every show you'll see a group of people just looking and pointing at particular details, or are they really looking at the yard in these circumstances?
No, the yard doesn't have much scenery on it. Mm. Although people do like to look at the trains that we set up there because that's where some of the, you know, the we set up there.
Certainly. Yeah, yeah.
So people like to see that. But no, you're right. The a lot of our scenes are well known. We have one privately owned module that is. We call it Jack's Snacks because the guy who owns it is named Jack. It's a nice little 4 foot module and he's got nice details on it. Nice. It's a candy factory. So he's got a nice, Lifesavers roll, mounted on top of the factory building. And that's a nice piece. And he's got this beautiful little diner over on the other side. It's one of those, I think Miller Engineering, diners. And it's just, he did a really nice job with it. And people like to look at that because he's got the nice little cars and stuff.
Certainly.
So that one is one that people often like to look at the details.
Yeah.
We have another one. We have, one that has a, you know, right up front is a nice little ice cream parlor, you know, with drive-in ice cream parlor where cars there. And of course, this is all in N scale. So it's real, you know, people have to lean in to look closely and stuff and, nice old cars and stuff like that. And that's across the tracks from the, from the car dealership and stuff. And there's often a lot of action there because that's that particular module is where we have some crossovers and some split outs. So if people go a slightly different route, that's where they're going to do it. So there's often some action there as well. Mm. So that's one that people like to look at as well. My own personal module is a city scene. Mm. A lot of people like to look at that. It's sort of funny because for me, I look at it and it's not finished. There's a lot more detail I have to put in. There's some other things to add, you know. So what I see is all the stuff that isn't there.
Oh, yeah.
But the people like to look at it. And it's one of the ones that people like to point out a lot. It's nice because you see the trains running through the city and there's a passenger station. Mm-hmm. So people like to look down the streets and see the trains. You'll see pictures, you know, on our Facebook page and stuff like that. It's one of the ones where people take pictures a lot because it's a nice street scene with the trains going by.
Oh, yeah.
So it's very photogenic that way. Another popular one that we have is there's a guy who built a junkyard. Mm. And that's got lots of details for people to look at. And people like to look in there and sometimes we'll challenge them. We're developing a sheet that we're going to start handing out to people of, you know, can you find this and that sort of thing, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, he's got a junkyard dog in there.
Oh, yeah.
And an N-scale dog.
Yeah.
That takes a little looking to find.
Certainly.
So that fellow has several modules that run nicely together. Mm-hmm. He's got wonderful details on several of them. He has one of our corner modules has a nice farm scene on it, and people like to look at the fruit and the trees and the fruit baskets and things like that. And he's got lots of little farm details. Mm. Those are the ones, so like I say, about half of stuff is just infrastructure to make the layout work.
Certainly.
And that's usually owned by the club.
Yes.
And those go to almost every show. The other stuff, are the privately owned modules. And those are ones that, people like to see. And, they come and go, you know, depends on who's showing up, who can make it to a show, what modules will be there. So it's a little harder to say for sure which ones are there, but there are ones that are starting to be well known and that people like to come and see.
Yeah. This is feedback that I wanted to give actually to the broader module community, particularly in N-scale, because I find, I mean, locally there are, I think, three separate N-scale module groups and only one of them appears to have this focus on detail. I think because stand-up comedians like to talk a lot, I find myself finding, you know, documentaries about stand-up comedy very frequently, because on Netflix primarily. And what strikes me through that is the stand-up comedians constantly, through live audiences, refine their work. Module clubs need to constantly, through attending shows, and you guys attend a lot of shows, which means you guys have gotten finer points associated with this, work out exactly what the audience likes to see. And I think something that I find really lacking in some of the local module groups is that they don't appreciate it's not just kind of long, winding, you know, trains areas where you're just running through grassland, because it's really easy to produce those modules very rapidly to take up a lot of space. The smaller modular groups that have a level of detail that draw people back every time, that have almost kind of kitschy levels of interest, because when you're dealing with the general public, you're not dealing... It's funny, actually, because you perfectly framed this by talking about the yard when I initially asked you about this. Model railroaders typically like things like yards, but a general public typically likes things as you described, like finding junkyard dogs or cityscapes with trains wandering through it. And really, there's almost a kind of competition between people's perception of being a model railroader when they are part of these modular groups versus going out and showing, you know, people who may not be into trains, who may just be looking for something to do in a morning or an afternoon. They've got a bunch of kids. They want to kind of keep occupied. And the ability for modular groups to kind of focus in on what the general public wants versus what model railroaders want is really an interesting thing that I wanted to put out there. Will, in terms of the length, so you've talked about various privately owned modules.
Yeah.
In terms of the length of time that these modules keep coming back to shows, we've talked a little bit in previous shows associated with just the amount of damage and wear and tear goes onto these modular components through regularly showing them. What is the average life expectancy for one of these kind of modules? Are they typically retired after 3 years, after 5 years, after 18 months? What's your sense on that?
Well, one of the things I like about N-Track is that the standards really haven't changed very much. So they really can have a very long lifespan.
Yeah.
You are right that wear and tear can play a big role in that. And they do tend to wear out after a while. But I think 5 to 10 years is not unreasonable. Some of these modules have been around for quite a while. And sometimes they live on. Mm. The one I was describing earlier with the ice cream stand.
Yes.
It was actually a rebuild. That was an older module that the club owned that it really had run its course. Mm. And it was not well built to begin with. Mm-hmm. And so we rebuilt it a year or two ago. And so it's we took some of the old parts, so some of the buildings and some of the scenic elements migrated to the new module.
Mm.
And then we improved the parts so that we took the things that didn't work and improved those and then kept the parts that we liked the module. Mm. And kept those with us. So, so when was this module built? Well, it sort of depends on how you count it. and we have a couple like that, where we've moved some of the parts on and rebuilt them to newer standards. Mm-hmm. The other thing is we've learned a lot about how to build them. I have one of the old original, N-Track, manuals from like 20 or 30 years ago, and we would never build a module according to those instructions because the thing would weigh so much.
Yes.
So we've learned ways to build modules that are more robust, more easily transported, and stuff. And so the basic standards work very well in that regard. But we have learned over the years how to redesign them so that our engineering at this point is pretty good. Mm. So we now know how to make modules that are very light and easily transported. Mm-hmm. And that's good because they take less of a beating that way.
Certainly.
We usually put our modules inside of packing crates. We call them coffins.
Certainly.
So many of our modules, most of our modules have some kind of, transport protection.
Mm.
So they don't get beat up that much.
Mm.
And, and that helps with that a lot too.
So you've given tantalizing elements to this, but not actually a blueprint for folks listening in. In terms of the way you build modules now, what techniques do you use that never existed, 15, 20 years ago?
One thing that we discovered several years ago is that what we do is when we build the frame, we build our frames usually out of 1x3 material and build the square rectangular frame. But then we put a sheet of like 1/8-inch Luan.
Mm-hmm.
And we cut it in. We cut a dado around, and it's inset just enough for a sheet of, like blueboard styrofoam, to fit on top. So we actually build our scene on top of the blueboard. But the blue board itself is sitting on top of a piece of Luan, that spans the entire thing. And that gives it a rigidity, but also remains light.
Certainly.
So it's very lightweight, but it's very rigid. So that piece is glued in, and it gives us a good solid foundation, but without adding a lot of weight.
Yes.
And then all of our modules have the legs built in.
Mm.
And we use, our legs are hinged on, so that they are very quick to, it's very common for when we take a module, we slide it out of the coffin, we just hold it up, reach under, unhook, and the legs drop down. So we never set the thing down except on its legs.
Yes.
Pretty much we believe that, each module should stand freely on its own unless there's a good reason not to.
Yes.
Now, corners are a little tough because corners don't really have a good dimension for legs. So some of our corners don't have legs. And so we carry some legs that we just clamp on at those times. But all of our basic modules should have the legs built in and stand on their own.
So we have a question from the chat from John Garrity, who unfortunately can't have audio because I think it's about 2 a.m. in Australia currently. But he's asking, in terms of actually connecting the modules, what's your standard for connection?
We use regular C-clamps, the 3-inch C-clamps, just like people have been using for many years. And one of the reasons why we like that is that they provide good rigidity, but they're very adjustable to whatever situation. So they're good. It's a good, strong connection that we've tried things like, using pins or using bolts through them, stuff like that. And the problem is that anytime you have, any kind of a standard where different people have to interpret the standard, they always interpret it a slightly differently.
Yeah.
That's one of the reasons why the N-track system of joining the rails with a piece of sectional track between is so important, because that gives you just a little bit of flexibility.
Mm.
The spec says that the track should be 1.5 inches apart. Somehow not everybody seems to manage to actually measure 1.5 inches quite the same way.
It's different everywhere. That's the thing.
It certainly seems to be.
Yes. Yeah, I think Einstein talked about the fact that distance was relative based on time or something, and I think that very much applies to module layout building.
Yes. So we're able to run modules where the tracks really don't line up because that 5 inches of gap between them gives us just enough flexibility that we can fudge things enough to get things to fit.
So a regular topic that we've been discussing recently, because I actually think it's doing serious damage to N-scale, is the lack of sectional and flex track. You guys obviously have modules. You probably have a back stash, as I do, associated with this kind of flex track. What are your thoughts associated with what's happening with N-scale currently with shortage of track?
Most of the track work that we do, our preference is regular Code 80 Atlas Flex track. So most of our track work is done with that.
Yeah.
Lately, we have been adding in a lot of the Kato track. And one of the reasons that we are using the Kato track more and more is that Kato makes a piece that's an expansion track. What we do is we have these Kato expansion tracks. So we use these Kato expansion tracks for the 5-inch connecting between modules, and that really speeds up our setup time because we just drop them in and put them in place. When a module has a Kato piece at the end, so you're snapping the Kato piece into another Kato piece, it works beautifully and very quickly because the Kato connectors are just automatically line up. It's very good.
Yes.
And so by using these, we now use them exclusively. And so all of our modules have been converted to use this, because what you have to do is take out the roadbed.
Certainly.
Because it's got the roadbed built in.
Yes.
And what we like about it is it still maintains the compatibility with the NTRAC standards. So if another module, an unconverted module, were to come, we could still fit it in.
Yes.
Because our modules still have compatibility with the NTRAC standard. But we just click these things in, and they're very quick. So our setup time, from the time we roll in and start unloading the trailer to the time we're running trains, is usually under 2 hours for almost any size layout.
Yeah. Jimmy, can you bring up your audio to ask the question directly?
Yes, hi, Will. I've got a question here. I'm doing a modular layout, or to be exact, a segment layout, where I do not follow any NTRAC or FREMO standards. I'm thinking, how do I connect the modules together, especially when I have tracks, because the tracks will not have, they will not be parallel, there will not be any sectional or a setback of 1 or 2 inches from the end of each module.
Well, I think, so the first question that I would have for you is this a module, is this a layout that's going to be set up and taken down fairly often, or is this a set it up once and leave it for a year or two?
I would say probably every 6 months, where I need to clean up the place. Yep. Fairly regular.
Okay.
Yeah.
See, the system that we use is designed for a show. Our typical show will come in the morning. You know, we come in at like 6 o'clock in the morning. We'll set up by 8 o'clock. We're running. We'll run for a couple of hours, and around 3 o'clock, we'll tear it all down and we'll be out by 4. And that's all one day. So we do a show like that very, you know, like I said, about 20 times a year. So for us, the, you know, being able to set it up quickly and often is really important. At our clubhouse, where we have a modular layout that we leave set up all the time, and we only very rarely take things in and out, we use the older NTRAC standard, where we take a piece of 5-inch commercial track, an Atlas 5-inch track, and fit that in there.
Right.
And that's the older NTRAC standard, and that's been working well for years. So that's not a bad way to go. Using the older technique takes a long time. Putting in each of those tracks is very time consuming. So we don't want to do it when we go to a show, because it takes so long, but it runs better. It runs better and it looks better. So if you have the time, you're only doing it even once every 6 months, a technique like that is probably a better way to go. That's what we use up at the clubhouse, because we don't take it, set it up and take it down all the time. You could go with the Kato track. One of the main reasons for using the NTRAC setback, there are two basic things. One, as I was talking about earlier, is that if there's any slight mismatch from one module to the next, you can usually fudge it a little bit with the connecting track and make it work. So we like to do that. That works well. The other thing is that because the track is set back, you don't get, the track doesn't get beat up by handling.
Right.
I'm intrigued by the FREMO technique of running it right up to the edge and just cutting it off flush. Mm-hmm. But if there's any mismatch in between the modules, I can't see how that would work. For a one track situation, I think that's a great idea. That'll work fine, because you can adjust the whole module to line it up. But if you've got multiple tracks, I don't know enough about FREMO to know how they handle that, or even if they handle that. Either of those techniques would be fine. Now, if you're just doing it for yourself, it doesn't have to be a 5-inch. You can use whatever size you works for you, I would think.
The challenge on my layout is basically the tracks doesn't run parallel or tangents to the end of the module. So basically, are designed in such a way there are two levels. They have a bottom level and there's a top level. And the tracks basically curve from one end to the other end. So there's no so-called straight end. I try to accommodate for a straight end as much as I can. But I got to think about how to put a setback on the layout so that, like you say, it makes it easier probably to attach the two modules and to make sure that the tracks run smooth together.
Yeah, one of the questions, and I see this comes up in the chat, is if the modules, if the modules are in a set order where the same module always goes against the same, the next module.
Yep.
Then you have a lot more freedom in one sense because you're just worried from one to the next, and you can just do whatever you want.
I see.
With the end track, mm-hmm. we have to. Conform to a set of standards, so the tracks have to come off in a particular way so that they can plug next to any module that also conforms to the standards. In a modular, in a true modular layout like N-Track, or Freemo, you have to deal with what your, you don't know what the next module is going to be. So you'll have to have a set of standards to tell you how to, build the connection so that it'll work with anything, with whatever comes next.
Okay. But in that case, my module is basically a fixed configuration. So each of them have their exact position, and therefore the challenge is just making sure that every time I remove them and putting them back, they have to align all the time.
Now, there's another person on this call, or at least he was earlier, that probably can weigh in on this, and that's Jim Lincoln, who built his chocolate module, and that's a set of modules that are in a fixed configuration, and he just uses a flush cutoff, but it's at whatever angle, he needed to run the track. So he may have something to weigh in on this, on how he did it.
So I'll explain what I did, and then you can – what I did was I put a piece of PC board material at the joins between modules, and then screwed them in so they weren't going to move. And then soldered, because I'm hand laying my track, I soldered the rails across so I have two pieces of PC board material roughly a quarter inch wide.
Right.
This is an N scale. And you butt those up again. Of course, you gap it like a tie, but I'm going to say they're 3 or 4 inches, maybe. Mm-hmm. They're 3 or 4 inches by a quarter of an inch. They go across the gap for each track. You lay the track across. You lay the rails across. You solder them in place with silver solder, and then you gap the rails at the join. So, and I have the way my modules are designed. There's not a lot. There is play in them, but there is not a lot of play in them. So basically, they're gonna go together like the kind of sorta. You just gotta fiddle with it a little bit, and then clamp it in place.
Right, I see.
If that answers your question, how I did it, but they're screwed. The PC board material is, I've got three screws holding it into the wood, which is on the ends of the joins, and then the rails are soldered across that, and then cut.
So you won't have problems of derailment at all when you have the PC board holding basically the two rails together.
Correct.
In the fixed positions.
Right. Yeah. And then you can hit them. As long as the PC board material is there, you can hit the rails, particularly with the silver solder. They don't move.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
Cause I had another one where I had cut the rails off near the end of the module going on to the extension going into the building that I just completed. And, those rails got damaged. Like the first time I moved the thing, those rails got damaged. But they were not in place with a piece of PC board material.
Oh, I see.
They were just there. They were there with one single tie and a bunch of wooden ties, but they weren't really glued very well because I knew I was going to be putting the PC board piece in there. And I thought because of where it was, oh, this isn't going to get hit. Well, it did.
Okay.
In transit. So doesn't matter where the track is on the module. Assume it's going to get destroyed if you don't do it.
Yeah. Because the challenge that I have is I have two, like I told Will, there are two levels, and mm-hmm. one is the hidden part. and the top level is visible. So how do I make sure that every time I put the modules back, that I don't have problem of derailment whenever the train runs through?
Right. So, yeah. This, you know, the reason why this works is, as I said, there's not a lot of play in how much the modules can move. So it's not like I don't have locator pins, but I have French cleats that hold the modules generally in the right place. And then I have on either side of the French cleat, there's the fascia comes halfway across the French cleat. So it kind of holds it side to side and up and down. So there's a little bit of play up and down. You get it where you need it to be. Before you lay the track down, you get it neat where you need it to be. You clamp everything together where it's going to be. Then you put the PC board down. You lay the rail down, solder it in place, cut it. Well, you lay the PC board material down and screw the living snot out of it. Because I have like half inch screws going into wood because I didn't really trust cement to hold it if it gets hit. On the extension, because it's not at the module joints, I wasn't as concerned about it. So I tried just Cypox, although I can screw it. It's not a big deal. It's just I'm trying it with just cement. But, you know, the extension's a lot lighter and the rails don't extend past the on the main module. The rails don't extend past the end. I cut them in a little bit inside the edge. So I'm hoping that it's not going to require me to screw in, because right there, there's a layer of homosote. There's a half inch layer of homosote there that where the rails are going. It's not wood at that joint. So I don't really have a solid. I'd have to have huge screws to hit wood to assure that it wasn't going to move. And if you screw into homosote, I'm sorry, you hit it hard enough, it's moving. So I wasn't going to worry about it too much. And then I don't know if that answers your question. So if it doesn't move very well and you can just solder the joint and then cut it, that's probably the – particularly on a module that's not going to be moved but every 6 months, it would probably be fine.
I see. I think this is a good suggestion. I should explore this because I'm still cracking my head as I lay the tracks. I've marked the tracks and I look at the positions of the tracks and where – to avoid, to make sure that the turnouts do not hit the end of the modules and everything else. And I'm like, okay, now I've settled one challenge and the next challenge is when I lay the tracks, how do I make sure that this piece of rail will always be at the exact position and not move? I think it is timely that I ask this question on the radio show. Thank you very much, Jim.
You're welcome.
Jimmy and Will. Thank you all very much for this amazing discussion. Will, I have to apologize to you. We get a lot of callers on Associated who are part of modular groups, and I think when you were first on Model Rail Radio, I didn't actually appreciate how much wisdom you had to convey on the topic. So it's been a real pleasure chatting with you today, Will, in particular, because I think the stuff that you've described, and I see, you know, there are at least three N-scale modular groups in my area, none of them have the breadth of wisdom that you have in your experiences associated with your particular club. Does your club, like, outwardly, I don't necessarily want to use the term preach, but is there a way that folks can get more information about the lessons learnt from your club? Or is it just a matter that people should gather together a series of questions so next time you're on Model Rail Radio, I can ask you directly? What is the way that people could find out this kind of information online, if at all?
Well, I'm in the Facebook group, and so they can always post something there or catch me through Facebook. That always works. We have a Facebook site. You can check out Keystone N-Track on Facebook, and we're there. We also have a website that's at www.keystonentrack.us. That's all one word, except, well, the .us part. That has our schedule. But if people have questions and want to know more about us, we're a fairly active club. We meet every Tuesday night. And people are welcome to come out. We'd love to have more people come out. Our philosophy is that it's in everybody's interest to, have people be successful in this hobby. So we're very active in helping any newcomers come.
So we answer any questions. We try not to keep secrets. You know, it's not about keeping secrets.
Certainly.
You know, the only reason I know anything is because somebody told me.
Yeah. I'm interested in particular the description that you gave associated with building each module with the foam insert to give both rigidity and also, you know, to make it as light as possible. I need to see that some way in order to, I mean, I have kind of an understanding of the way you described it, but I think a photo or two of that particular technique would be very useful in terms of communication. So I'm sure there's somewhere through the information that you've provided, a photo of that nature will be there, I'm sure.
I'll see what I can do. You know, that of course would be, you know, something on the Facebook page.
Yes.
I'll see if I can, do something like that because that would be good. Of course, come out to one of our shows and we'll point out anything you want to know. You know, other than trying to describe it over the phone here is, as you point out, is, a little hard to be clear about that, but, so yeah, well, you know, that's the way to go, I think. I'll see what I can do. It very well could be that we can post some pictures. But yeah, that's the thing is, you know, we try and move this state of the art forward, to make them, you know, strong, light, and flexible, and stuff. So, because it makes, you know, like I say, it's very nice. We can roll in and set up in 2 hours and be running.
Oh, yeah.
And that includes hooking up DCC and everything.
Yeah.
And that makes a one-day show, you know, a viable thing to do.
Yeah.
You know, I remember back in the older days where you'd have to come in the day before and set up for, you know, several hours.
Yes.
Because it took several hours to set one of these things up.
Yeah, I'm not going to name any names, Dave Falkenberg in particular, but the number of times I've turned up at shows where this particular layout group, struggling with, as you say, putting the legs on underneath and everyone's kind of lifting, a particular module to try and get this whole thing together. I mean, the blueprint you've laid out here, Will, I hope people who are listening into this who belong to modular groups that aren't yet doing these very basic things will, I don't know how you actually move a group of people, but I hope that your audio today has been convincing enough to at least motivate some discussion within these modular groups associated with, firstly, level of detail on particular sections of the layout to draw an audience. Number two, the modular techniques that you're describing, in particular the lightness, but also the legs that are attached. And number three, actually paying attention to, for example, which other modular groups might be getting more people, but also the fact that the overthinking part of a hobby that seems to go into it is really not applicable when you're dealing with frequent shows. Will, you have given a blueprint here, and I really hope, the number of folk who are listening in who belong to module groups, particularly in N-Scale, take notice to what you've said today. Thank you very much for the chance to chat.
Well, I thank you.
I'd like to welcome back on Winston Norton. Winston, it's probably been about a year, maybe even a year and a half since we last talked on Model Rail Radio. I really enjoyed your son's YouTube video of your layout. It answered a number of questions for me. What's been going on in your model railroading hobby since you last called in?
Oh, changes and ups and downs. Not a great deal of progress on the 00 layout.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about the end track.
Certainly.
We have a 00 module, mm-hmm. which is the same system as N-Track, which different people have different modules. We put them all together. Spent yesterday working on that for the British show, which is in Toronto.
Oh, yes.
Next weekend. I don't think I can get there, but the layout will be going down there.
Wonderful.
And I've just been putting dowel pins in the ends of all of it. As the lineup is the... It's a difficult thing at times.
Certainly.
As you say, particularly when it's all being humped up and down and moved. But we managed to get a 20-foot by 20-foot layout put together in 2 hours.
So your module is going, but you are not. Is this what you're saying?
That's the way it is. The layout is going, but I'm not going to make it.
So this is a show that we've been talking about for probably about nearly 5 years now, because when Chris Abbott was first on, he speaks very highly of this particular British train show, both in terms of the quality of modelling, but also just the, well, the quality of modelling, both in terms of what is displayed, but also what is represented in terms of the people that turn up to the show. So you have both the ability to see a lot of stuff, but also talk to really interesting people. Do you get there periodically? I mean, are you there like every other year, or is this just something where you'll work on your module and then send it on to the show?
Well, the show is every other year.
Oh, is it? Okay.
And I would have been down there this weekend, but the old health reasons, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not going to make it this weekend. But apart from that, what I have been working on, as I said, a change of course, is a 7/8 2-foot scale model.
Interesting.
You've been talking a lot about 3D printing.
Mm-hmm.
I've 3D printed the body of a Model T Ford.
Ooh.
In 7/8 to the foot scale.
Yeah.
It's worked out really well. It's the first 3D print I've ever had, and I'm really impressing myself. I'm making it with somebody else. He's making the same one. He's got a lot of experience in working in the scale, so everything I need to get, he knows where to get it. I had this one made by Shapeways, and he had his made by Sculptor.
Okay.
Both quality, from quality, both were fine, were perfect.
Mm.
Sculptor, I had a bit of problem getting them to make the model. It was a SketchUp model, which is probably not perfect for 3D. Shapeways came through with it fairly quickly, but of course, when I got round to them, I'd made a lot of changes to it. The Sculptor. But here in Canada, Shapeways sent by US Mail. Sculptor sent it by UPS. And UPS gives us brokerage charges and all kinds of stuff. It cost me nearly $39 to get it here. The Shapeways one was $8, I think, for shipping and handling. Makes a big difference.
Certainly.
But that's what I've been doing now. At the moment, I'm busy putting a wooden floor onto a caboose. Now, this caboose is 7/8 scale, and the floor of the caboose is 21 inches long, 5.5 inches wide.
Gosh.
And it's nice when you can use a table saw and a thickness planer to make materials to make a model from. So I guess I'm going to have a little bit of this in my basement, and it'll probably get down to something in the garden next year, but the year after. Talking about basements, just to show I have been listening to the show, Tom, how's your basement doing?
Thank you, Wits. Thank you for asking me this question. I am currently... The basement is... I mean, I talk very positively about having a basement, but truth be told, I've spent less than 20 minutes in the basement, and because of the way that I go to the house periodically, we're not yet moved in, every time I go to the basement, I have a new question for myself that I have to answer. The first was associated with lighting, which makes me realize that I have to put in a lot more lighting. The second was associated with power feed, which there are two plugs in the basement. I need to put in more power. I need to put in more lighting. The third is associated with the fact that the basement is finished in the section that you can move around, but is open air to a section which is unfinished. So what method do I use to close off that section? So it's easily accessible when it needs to be accessible, but it is closed off for all intents and purposes. Similarly, painting. Similarly, of an era when the basement was first built, so probably a 1920s, maybe even earlier, desk, which is built into the basement. But the actual drawers of the desk, you can move in and out, but they're very old. It's very heavy wood. And I don't want to remove it necessarily, but it basically blocks off a large usable section of the basement, this huge desk. I'm going to take video footage of the basement as well to actually describe it to people, but the lighting isn't particularly good. I can use lights to show it. I think I have about a year's worth of work in the basement alone just to finish it to a level where I can put a layout in. The benefit, however, of this house, because it's big in terms of the room space, is that I have a dedicated room that I'm going to use for podcasting, layout building, all the variety of books and magazines and other detritus that I've collected over the past however many years. That space gives me an ability to do active modelling. It gives me two areas where I can do 15-foot long shelves of maybe a foot wide, maybe a bit longer, which I'll put on top of bookshelves here, but it be at about 5-foot level, which is exactly the right height for me to work on. And that area gives me a lot of opportunity to do basic modelling, basic, you know, skill building while I finish the basement. The basement itself, I think, is probably going to be at least a year long. a lot of the feedback that I've gotten from Matt Goodman in particular, associated with lighting basements, but also we had on Ron Klaas a little earlier, Ron as well, have given me really good information associated with what I need to do with finishing the basement. Things like, for example, painting the brickwork. Whether or not, and I need to establish this, because this basement has basically been uncovered and abused for 70 plus years. So I need to establish whether the dust level in the basement is based on 70 plus years or whether it's based on bad design and the dust leaking in. Now, the floor above the basement currently is all linoleum on top of wood with carpet on top of linoleum. So in that regard, the basement is effectively sealed above, and I think we're probably going to end up scraping off the linoleum, but through that process we can probably finish the upper section to reduce the dust that's coming down. So there are all these things that I'm thinking about currently, with the view, as I've said, that I've spent roughly 20 minutes or less in the basement currently, mainly because of lighting, mainly because of a variety of other reasons that it's actually quite dingy and, you know, but it is a beautiful basement that has just been abused up until now. So my view is I'll certainly take some video footage. I'll certainly put it online to give folks an idea of the space. I don't know what I'll do with the desk. I think based on the way that we've already decided to maintain the house, I think the desk is probably staying, and I'll probably utilize it for a variety of different purposes. But I just need to work out how I actually kind of finish that thing. But yeah, the basement is hot on my mind, Winston. It's something I'm going back. Literally, I'm finishing the show early so I can go to the house, meet with a contractor, plant the tomato garden that I've had in sectional bits here. But yeah, I will be spending some quality time in the basement because the gas leak, there were four holes in the gas, what have you, was fixed. So I can actually spend more quality time down there without gassing myself. So that's the first piece of progress. But yeah, how I do the finishing is actually really interesting because I want to maintain access. I also get the sense that the structural elements of the basement I need to be very mindful of. I'm very mindful of your question here, Winston. I'm going to be giving periodic updates for folks who want to see a basement empire layout built in the next year. You're going to be a little bit off, unfortunately, and apologies to folks that want to see this. This is a basement that has been abused. It's a basement that could be used in a horror film currently, the Saw movies, this kind of stuff. My sense is, however, that with a bit of TLC, a lick of paint, some good lighting, improvement of the electricals, I probably won't need to do, and this is actually, I've looked back at Matt Goodman's footage associated with painting the floor joists black and all this kind of stuff, or a light, a dark grey. These kind of techniques I think I could probably use. I need to get a sense of what the actual dust surface is. It's a cement floor, which I'm relatively mindful of. I think I might put something down to be walk-on friendly rather than just the cement floor, particularly after doing a lot of work down there. I think that might be an upgrade that needs to be done. An infinite set of possibilities here, Winston.
Well, I think the main thing to think about when doing anything is to make sure it's flexible.
Yeah.
My lighting, I have ceiling tiles down on a grid. I lose very little height through it. And small pot lights, ceiling tiles. If I want to move a light, at the very most, I'm going to have to buy a new ceiling tile.
Yeah.
So, you know, I can put extra lights in, take lights out if I need to.
Yeah.
Being flexible, I think, is the most important thing. I know my basement has changed a lot in those 25 years I've lived in this house.
Yeah, I don't think I'll put in ceiling tiles because the space at the top is critical. And I'm actually quite mindful associated with hanging lights as well. So I'm trying to think of a lighting solution currently. There are two hanging lights in the area, one of which is operated by a switch as you enter the basement. The other has one of those kind of pull-down chain things. I like the switch. I would like to put more lights in on the switch. But the way in which I put in the lights, and particularly because currently they're hanging lights, which aren't really appropriate, I've got to find another lighting solution that is relatively flexible. I think within the space, and particularly looking at Matt Goodman's basement, where there are fixed lights, but he's also put in the ability to do mobile lighting too, I think might be the best of both worlds in that scenario. But I really need to take some YouTube footage, and I apologies to the folks listening in. I will take some YouTube footage. I may actually, and this is very scary, particularly for the likes of Chris Abbott and the folks who constantly complain associated with my shaky hand cam footage, I may actually put the video footage in the feed, in the Model Rail Radio feed, for people to view and feel nauseous at, just to convey what this space is. Because I think it has a huge amount of potential. And I also think that I need constant feedback. And thankfully, through the likes of, you know, Ron Klaas, now your own feedback here, Winston. Matt Goodman in particular. I've had such a good collection of feedback associated with how you start this process that I'm very mindful of the responsibility, let's call it what it is, of having the luxury of a basement, particularly in an area that has very few basements, but also that I have to make a series of choices now in the very starting points of having a basement that will make the difference between having a beautiful space, a space that I want to spend a large quantity of time in, versus having something which is just a kind of haphazard series of mistakes. And I think rather than kind of jumping in boots and all, I'm using this time as much as possible to create an environment. And I think here it's the feedback of Peter Burt here too, that I'll want to actually spend a good quantity of time in producing, you know, something that I'm actually very proud of. And thank you for asking about that, Winston. It's top on my mind currently.
Okay.
In terms of listening in over, you've noted you've listened in with quite a degree of detail over the past year or so since you were last on. Are we missing any topics? Is there anything you'd like to... I remember that we talked a little bit associated with computerization when you were last on. Are there any other topics that we should be covering that you'd like to hear about?
No, I don't really think so. Possibly a little bit more into 7/8 scale and the big stuff, but that's very much in the future now.
We'll try.
Just starting. No, I enjoy listening to the program most of the time. Some things I don't, but that's what happens when you have a lot of people listening, isn't it? You can't keep everybody happy all the time.
Exactly. But I hope you've learnt the trick associated with fast-forwarding, and I would recommend that to people. I try to cover as much as possible, and if there are topics which are just too deep or what have you, you have the ability with a lot of these things that play the audio to podcast now to just keep fast-forwarding until you find a topic that you can gel with.
I tend to listen to most of the podcasts in bed at the end of the day. So I've learned the technique of going back the next day because of the ones that I miss when I fall asleep.
Very good. Well, I'm glad that I'm also helping you fall asleep. I think that's a beautiful thing.
Well, if I don't wake up in the middle of the night, I don't know, I'll switch it on and listen to you.
Very good. Thank you very much for calling in, Winston. Great to catch up. Please do. I mean, if these morning times are better for you, I'm going to endeavour, as I always say, to record more of these morning shows to catch up with folks such as yourself. Thank you for calling in. Look forward to catching up in the future.
Nice talking to you, Tom.
Take care, Winston.
Bye.
I'd like to welcome back on Anders. Anders, last time we chatted, you had moved locations, you changed your layout, you'd done a variety of things which were really very interesting in terms of setting it both in Sweden and New York.
Yeah.
How's it going? That's
just a basic, that's an idea that I have, that I am going to make it possible to sort of relocate it between New York and Stockholm. But I'm basically building as before Isola or Brooklyn, Queens. But, if I can manage to do lift out buildings, I can manage to, well, I have to build, I think, 3 buildings in a different manner that will make it more Swedish. The rest will, what's it called, where you have a grain silo. Mm-hmm. Silo. It doesn't make any difference. It looks the same in New York and Stockholm. So, but of course, there will be problems like signage and things like that, but it would make it possible for me to use both my Swedish equipment and my Isola equipment.
Your Isola equipment and your New York equipment?
No, Isola, Isola is New York.
Oh, okay, sorry.
Or maybe Isola, I'm not sure how it's supposed to be pronounced. Have you ever read the Ed McBain series of mysteries?
No, I haven't.
It's about 50 books or something like that. Started in 1956.
Okay.
And his Manhattan is called Isola, and then his Brooklyn is Conn's Point and so on.
Mm.
And the city is called Isola City.
Interesting. I think you've mentioned that previously. I associate the name Isola with Sweden for some reason. It could be anyway, interesting. So, Anders, you've avoided talking about this explicitly, but I'm just going to put this out there.
Okay.
How far are you into building this new layout?
Not far at all. No, I haven't had time to do much. When I moved, that's 9 months ago now. First, I was dead set on reusing the old layout as it was and just keep on building on that. Or more or less, I was dead set on using 2/3 or 3/4 of it, something like that. But it just took up too much space in my living room and it just wasn't habitable. So I had to redo my plans. So I spent maybe 3 months on redrawing it so that it just goes just along one wall, the long wall in the room. It's 5 meters, so it's okay in space. And so it's more or less a shelf layout, even though it's not a shelf. But so I've drawn that, and but then I haven't had that much time to build after that. Mm-hmm. You know, moving, reshaping a new living space and everything like that. Work, kids, and then. But I've done weathering.
Oh, yeah.
On some boxcars, some Swedish boxcars. I think I've published some photos of a weathered boxcar on the Facebook pages.
Mm. Yes. So in terms of, I mean, your previous layout was pretty well along. It was pretty well developed. At least by the folks that call into Model RAR on a regular basis, if that is a standard. When you packed up and moved, how much of that stuff did you retain? I mean, you took the models off, I'm assuming. Did you maintain any of the sections of track or anything, or did all of that go?
Well, at first, I was dead set on reusing it, and it was built in sections. Mm-hmm. It's not it wasn't a modular, but it was built in sections.
Certainly.
So I just put those sections apart and I relocated them. I put them together, but I realized it didn't work. So after that, I've demolished it.
Mm.
So there's nothing left of that. Well,
the structures?
It's in boxes. Okay. Yes, the structures are left, of course. Because I'm going to reuse most of the structures I had built.
Certainly.
To that layout. Yes. I actually draw the plans with that in mind.
Certainly. Mm. No, I recall that. In terms of you're not getting your model railroading fix aside from weathering at home. Are you still, are you still attending clubs? Do you still have other locals that you do model rail related stuff? How great was your move in terms of area? Did you move a completely different area, or are you still able to go back to some of the folks that you used to do train related stuff with?
No. My move, it was just floor. I live one floor below where I used to live. it was a really, really spaced out thing, you know, that we were able to move with the people who lived underneath us.
Gosh. Was it a larger, I mean, are you moving into bigger spaces, or was it just more convenient? No, smaller.
No, it's a smaller, yeah.
Ah, interesting.
I separated. So, and that was even more strange. I mean, that the coincidence that the person who lived below us together with someone else not far away from here wanted to live in our apartment so we could take their two apartments and so I just moved one floor down.
Gosh.
Yeah.
Gosh.
But I, of course, we lived very large apartment before and now I live, I guess, more like most people, you know.
Yeah.
It's more adapted to me and my daughter, so.
Yeah. Interesting. I mean, when I stayed in Stockholm, I stayed in an absolutely tiny apartment where basically it was just a single room that did everything and then a tiny kind of shower bathroom. I don't know. It would have been probably 300 square feet or less. I mean, it was really very small, but
And for the European listeners, that's approximately 30 square meters.
Yes. Maybe even less than that. That seems luxurious when described. The thing that interested me through that is I actually quite like what I call Muskvite living, because the folks in Moscow lived in those kind of spaces, because it creates a degree of economy where you have to think very well about space.
Yes.
In terms, so you have obviously gone through this process in terms of your new layout space.
Yeah.
I'm really looking forward to actually seeing the building progress associated with this. So you're still, returning to my question a couple of questions ago, you're still you're still exactly the same distance away from your other, you know, your other train buddies, for want of a better term.
Yeah.
Are you spending time with them still? Are you, you know, getting your train fixed through their endeavors as well?
Oh, well, I think I've talked about this before. More or less get my train fixed through all of you guys in this community and the community, so social media communities, because I've never felt very much togetherness with the people in Stockholm. So I have a few friends, and yeah, we meet on and off, you know, but they don't have their own layouts. One of them are building, but he's been building that for 10 years, I guess, or something, and he still hasn't something to show. He will be building for the rest of his life, I guess.
Yeah.
And then there's Lars. I think you've all seen pictures from Lars, who built the crane.
Yeah, certainly.
And we meet on a regular basis and talk, and, you know, we visit, there's a club in Stockholm, which professor, he visited with him on that club.
Yes.
And we go there sometime, and yeah, I guess that's it. I think I'm a loner. I don't know. I like to build myself.
Yeah, certainly.
Yeah.
And I mean, the nature of your kind of vocational interests as well lend itself very heavily to, you know, modeling at a particular level. I think this is the thing that always interests me when people call in as a kind of secondary thing. I like to know what people do professionally, because it gives me a strong sense of their, you know, particular interests. You know, engineers will design particular kinds of layouts. People who are work in kind of visual aesthetics will, you know, design. So yeah, I think there's a very interesting
historians will
there.
Do something, and and designers like me,
and that
it's very true, because That's probably why I like to work on my own, because it's all in my head. It's not like I'm doing prototype. So I can't point at a building or something like that and say, build that, help me build that.
Yes.
Because it's all in my head.
Yes.
I see something before me and I want to get there.
Yes. Anders, it's been a really nice chance to catch up. Apologies. And for folks listening in, Anders is like one of the longest suffering European listeners on Model Rail Radio. Almost every live show, Anders will call in and listen from, like, I don't know, what, 1 a.m. through to 7 a.m. And you're never in a coherent, I mean, you're just typically, you know, I try sometimes to get snippets of your audio. I rarely end up using it, because obviously it's late night and you're just brutally listening in no matter what happens. But it's wonderful to have a chance to catch up with you and talk reasonably.
Yeah. Well, I'm sensible.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, as you might have noticed lately, I've stopped listening to 7 a.m. and I'm just listening for 2 hours, like 2:30 or 3 a.m. or something like that. And I just had to hit the bed.
Yes.
Because I realized I destroyed the next day.
Yes.
Every time I tried to stay on.
Yes.
And that also, it's a bad thing about that is that I always seem to miss the off-show chats, because they happens either after the shows or at the same time as the regular show. So they're not exactly European friendly.
Well, here's an interesting thing with those off-show chats, because my suspicion is maybe 3 or 4 shows ago, I recorded from 8 p.m. my time to midnight. Actually, it ended up finishing well after midnight, maybe, well, closer to 1 a.m. my time. My sense is that if I recorded at those later times, the off-show chats, and I don't necessarily know if this is the case, but if you're not a morning person, Anders, maybe this doesn't work for you either. But if we did off-show chats from those recordings, it would work into be about 8 or 9 a.m. starting for the off-show chats your time. What I've encouraged people to do is actually do off-show chats irrespective of, you know, the actual recording. So what we the vernacular for people listening in is typically what we call a post show, which is we'll record a show and then typically Mike Slater or someone else will host a post show. There are also off show chats which occur at any time the show isn't being recorded. I would encourage folk to, particularly European listeners, and we've got, you know, we've got Jimmy Lowe who asked specifically for this show this morning. Why don't you guys get together and, you know, specifically record off-show chats at times that are more friendly, and then we can, you know, and that also gives some momentum as well. So I'd encourage the European listeners and, you know, potentially the Australian listeners and the folks in Asia and these kind of things to start up these off-show chat groups. Record them at any time. The other thing that I've gotten feedback about is that the off-show chats that are typically recorded when the show isn't being recorded cover a variety of topics, and there are people that would like to record off-show chats about a specific set of topics, and there are other people that would like just general conversational off-show chats. Do whatever you want in that format. If you want to create another off-show chat that goes in a different direction, say, you know, we're creating a narrow-gauge off-show chat here, or we're creating an N-scale off-show chat, and if people want to call in, we'll be talking predominantly about N-scale or narrow-gauge, but please feel free to call in. I think all these kind of formats can work. And Anders, you've been doing this thing with Model Rail Radio for, I think, probably, I know actually, because when I first moved up here was, I think, the first time that you called in, and it was roughly 2.5 years ago. So I know almost exactly how long you've been participating, maybe 2.75 years now.
No, I think it's 3 years.
Yeah, actually. Coming up to 3 years. Mm. And I would encourage folks such as yourself, people that have been part of the community, start throwing up when you have free time, and obviously you don't have a lot of free time, but when you have a bit of free time, throw up in the Facebook group maybe a day before. I'm going to be on Skype between these times and give, you know, local times, maybe GMT or something like that as well. And just say to people, you know, if you're on Skype, Skype me. And what, yeah, you create the off-show chat you want to be listening to, Anders.
Mm.
How does that sound?
Yeah, well, I don't have that kind of Skype accounts, and I don't have a recording equipment.
No. This doesn't have to be recorded. In fact, okay. It really doesn't need, it shouldn't be recorded. I think a lot of this stuff really shouldn't be recorded. But my view is actually that just having the community of people talking and showing their modeling, and some of these off-show chats, they throw in video and these kind of things, all of which Skype can do without paying anything. Just gives you the opportunity for you to kind of reach out to a broader community. We've had on a variety of folk that have actually come to the show, not because they found it through Facebook or anything, but because they found individuals on Facebook. Mike Slater is a good example of this. People will befriend Mike Slater, and within, you know, a few minutes of befriending him, they'll realize that he's part of this Model Rail Radio thing. Well, what's Model Rail Radio? The easiest way is just to get on an off-show chat with Mike, typically. And then he introduces Model Rail Radio to a variety of folk. If you host an off-show chat periodically, this could be at any time, you will actually bring people in that have never heard of Model Rail Radio, and then they'll end up calling in the regular shows. So I think the off-show chat as a kind of community gathering thing on the internet is actually very useful to bring in people who then call into the regular shows and then become part of the wide variety of personalities that we had before.
Yeah, well, I think it is a good idea that not one, but maybe some of us here in Europe should host an off-show chat.
Definitely.
Because it would mean that, I mean, most of those people wouldn't be able to sit up from 1 a.m. to 7 a.m. So it would put some pressure on having more Euro-friendly recording times of the shows.
Yeah.
So that would be good. I mean, if I may comment, there's another European right now that I think has taken my place as the late night owl. That's Sven. Because Sven seems to be up when I go to bed every time.
Yeah, you tagged him.
The last theft.
You tagged him. It's actually interesting because what I wanted to do with this particular recording is try to reach out to people, firstly, who'd never called in, or people such as yourself, who I rarely have an opportunity to talk with for an extended period of time. Winston's also in that as well. And yeah, when Sven came on, I thought, I talk to Sven every episode. Sven can stay in the background today, even though we've talked about some of his scales. Next time, you know, I'm doing a regular recording, I know Sven's going to be on. I know we're going to have the opportunity to chat. So it is interesting, you're kind of behind the scenes associated with that. But you're right. Sven is carrying the torch for you.
Yeah, but maybe you would have some other answers now that Sven is also not groggy.
Hmm. Ah, interesting point. Sven, do you have audio?
I think so.
Sven, we were talking a little earlier with Winston associated with 7/8 inch to the foot scale. This is not the same scale that you're modelling in, but it's a kind of compatible heft. Am I right? This is not the scale that you're modelling in.
I'm on a 3.5 inch gauge.
Okay.
So the larger scale is 7.25 inch, I think, mm-hmm. is the next step up. Mm-hmm. And that gets really heavy and really big.
Sven, I haven't had the opportunity to congratulate you with regards to your third place, but still, as far as I'm concerned, winning entry into the Garage Layout Design Contest. When you listened into that show, do you have anything to add associated with your particular layout, associated with the other two folk in the top three?
To my layout, not really. It's not really a good design because it's all straight and very crowded with track. Just wanted to try to get this large scale in such a small space, even in a small room, like a 10 by 10 foot, it's easy to set this thing up and get at least a logo and a couple of cars moving.
Certainly.
In this particular large scale. But it's really not really a design winner. Let's put it this way.
It was interesting because your entry was the first entry, but it was also very provocative. And I think the ability to have slightly less right angular, which is the feedback that I gave in the recording, but I think the modelling was of a sufficiently high standard, and Lionel talked on this explicitly as well, that it was just very captivating. And I think certainly that's the feedback that I would give, that you've picked a format which is particularly captivating, and whether you're modelling in NHO or any other scale, you can still get a lot out of the format that you've picked. Well, Anders, Sven, a pleasure as always catching up with you both. Anders, I hope I've empowered you to create an off-show chat, maybe talk more with Sven, maybe talk more with... Oh, this is a final question I wanted to ask you, Anders, before we wrap it up. Your European takeover show that you organized, how long ago it was, 2 years ago. The folk that appeared on that, I've been following through Facebook, in particular new layouts that they're building.
The Dutch people,
certainly. It would be absolutely wonderful to get those folk back on. Yeah. Are you still in regular communication with them?
No, I am not, actually. I've been in touch with one of them since then, but I'm a bit disappointed, actually, that none of them ever called back after that. It seems as if they thought of it as a magazine article or something like that, you know. It's not so strange because I'm not so sure that lots of people are familiar with this community thing.
Yeah.
If you haven't run into it before, this is a very different way of interacting with other people than you're used to if you're 65 or something like that, you know. But if we would like to, I can get in touch with them and ask them if they would like to reappear.
Yeah. Janus, who appeared on that show and I think called into a future show.
He did, but he didn't talk, did he?
Well, he has called back into a few shows, and the problem with the format now is that particularly when I get on new callers, but also when I get on people with sizable updates, I'll see these people come on, and Janus is one of these people, and Janus, I'm talking specifically here to you. He stays on for about half an hour, which is tantalizing because I want to get to him, and then just when I'm ready to get to him, he hangs up. So he has called back in, and you've seen him, obviously, because you've been on the calls as well. I don't know, maybe 3 or 4 times. And a topic that I've wanted to discuss is people who are in the process of changing careers and interested in building or interested in becoming hobby store owners. And we had on Caesar Luna the first time. I think it was really bad audio for Caesar. We talked to him initially, and then he called back in, and he wanted that topic to be discussed. And Janus came on through that call as well, and I thought, this is building momentum. I'll get Janus in, I'll get Caesar in. And by the time I was ready, and I can't recall what was happening up until that point, both of them had hung up. So I think what I'm going to have to do is just prioritize, particularly when Janus calls in, to stop everything. Get him on for a few minutes and then get him back to the regular show, because I feel really bad for Yanis in particular, because he is someone who I think did get the format and has called back in, and he obviously enjoys listening in as well. But he is someone who I really want to get an update from.
Yeah, and he was very communicative as well, and agrees model. That's not the most usual thing.
Exactly. But also someone who has a hobby shop, who has been able to survive through a particularly brutal...
A part-time hobby shop, wasn't he?
Yeah.
He worked at bank as well, didn't he?
Yeah.
But I mean, you have to do that, I guess. I mean, it's like when Dave Frary called in. You stop everything and just get on to him. You have to do that with Yanis, and I think you should do that as well if we can manage to get Trolls on.
Yeah.
Because Trolls would be really interesting. He started to making models in a very large scale.
Yeah, no, he's completely... We got him on, I think, twice. Maybe it was just once, but with a lot of information. I seem to recall at least twice we've had Trolls on. And he is someone as well who, you're right, like Dave Frary. I mean, similar cut. Would stop everything. But I don't think I've heard from him in a couple... I bought his last DVD, which was really phenomenal. And I certainly point a lot of people to his YouTube channel, non-modelers, and I still do that. But he's someone as well who, you're right, has just dropped out of the communication because he hasn't called in recently.
No, he hasn't. I haven't heard from him. I heard from him now this Easter because he had an exhibition with his paintings, and I was invited, but I couldn't go, sadly. He lives 600 kilometers from here. So.
Yes.
No, not 600. No, that's not right. It is.
Yeah,
600 kilometers from here. Yeah. So it's quite a distance. Yeah. You can't really go there for an exhibition.
Yeah.
And I mean, there were quite a few people there that would have been nice to have back in the shows.
Certainly.
Yeah. Now for the European off-show chat, it seems to have caught fire here on the chat.
I hope so.
Andy Dixon and J-Lo seems to have, they are dead set on having a European off-show chat now, it looks
Is J-Lo an authorized nickname, or have you just coined an authorized nickname here?
He actually suggested it himself. So.
Very good.
Yeah.
Jimmy?
No, because people are calling me J-Lo, and they say, all right, that's a good name.
Okay. If it's approved by you, I will use it in the future.
Yeah. Hopefully I don't get sued by the real J-Lo.
Yeah, I don't think it's likely, but you never know. You never know.
But I spelled it different, Jimmy, so shouldn't be any problem.
Shouldn't be a problem. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, look, I think there are a sufficient number of you. I mean, Tom Cutting featured some... Andy met up with Tom Cutting at a show recently? I mean, all these folk who we've gotten on periodically, but have just kind of continued to carry the torch associated with going to local shows, wearing Model Rail Radio t-shirts and hoodies and all this other kind of stuff, and have just kind of kept it alive. I mean, hats off to our wide variety of folk who've called in Europe and the UK. We need to... Anders, J-Lo, it's your responsibility now to reinvigorate this community. And more importantly, and I think you make a very good point here, Anders, if you can get this group active, the requirement for me to actually put more European-friendly show times together is definitely there.
Mm.
I think we can do that because with Andy.
The
time difference is quite probably very much of the reason why those Dutch gentlemen never called back. I mean, they're not used to being up at 1-2 a.m. So they don't really go looking for whenever we have a European friendly show. So
yes. Okay, so you've convinced me. You've convinced me.
And also, the weekends are also family time, so for a lot of Europeans. But maybe what we can do is the European off-chat show could organize ourselves, and then one of us will bring our discussion to the main chat show as a summary of what happened in the Europe side.
And, all it takes is one of you to get... For me, it cost, I think, $29, maybe $25 US, the call recording software for Skype as well. And if one of you gets that and actually records one of these shows, I have no problem in editing the audio and putting it out on the feed as well.
We'll check this out.
Definitely. I'd like to welcome back on Mike Deverell. Mike, you have set a number of people's interest off in terms of, firstly, computerization of layouts. Secondly, empowering people in your local community. I'm not sure if you had the opportunity to hear my conversation with Jeff in Dover last recording, but Jeff, similar to you, is connected with the scouting organization and does the scouting merit badge. And I know your layout has at least been featured associated with the scouting merit badge previously. What's going on with your model railroading hobby currently?
Well, Tom, if you take a look at Facebook there, you'll notice that the Colorado and Coyote Creek is no more.
I saw that. And I was actually stunned by that because I thought to myself, the only reason someone such as Mike would do this is if he had a mind-blowing, phenomenally uncharted layout planned. I'm assuming this is the case.
Well, Tom, when I last talked to you, which has been almost 6 or 7 months ago, shortly after I talked to you, an opportunity to move and be out where Matt Goodman is, to move to Ohio, came up, and that kind of put everything on hold. And so as I went through that process, the goal of looking at the layout and saying, what do you like? What don't you like? What would you change if you were to do it again? And as I went through that process, and it took us almost 6 months before we decided that, no, we were not going to move to Ohio. Mm-hmm. But at that point in time, I had already kind of sketched out a couple of ideas and some things like that and evaluated the layout. And I sent a copy to Tony and a few other model railroading friends I know and said, hey, guys, what do you think of this? It would be a prototype railroad rather than a rail fanning layout. Mm. And started to get things going. And before too long, I looked at John and I said, John, we're tearing the layout down.
What was John's initial reaction?
Well, let's just say John looked at me like, we've been working on this for 10 years. And I said, yeah, well, and to be fair, I have to give credit to, I don't know, too many folks have probably taken a look at it, but Trainmasters TV. Mm-hmm. I was listening to Lionel and talking about tearing down his layout.
He's a dangerous man, that Lionel Strang.
He is very dangerous. And as I was looking at it, he made a statement that just kind of rang true as I had gone through the evaluation and everything, which was, if the layout's no fun anymore, it's not a hobby.
Ooh.
And just kind of got to the point of saying, you know what? I really would like to try this. And so I posted the new layout plan. And as you can see, it's got almost 360 feet of mainline run.
Yeah.
So it's just better use of the space. And I spent the time doing a lot of proto studying and using U.S. Geological Survey maps from 1959 to 61 to design the plans, and away we went. So John's actually become a one-man wrecking ball, and I had to slow him down a couple times and tell him, whoa, 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 we still need that stuff.
That was one of the things that really caught me about, and I guess I've caught up with this last night. I mean, that's when I saw the photos. I guess I'm scrolling down. And I really, in terms of the sound that I made, the inhaling and just general shock associated with how, and this is advice you should give back to Lionel. This thing should go full circle. The fact that you can remove a layout like that, and a layout which, for all intents and purposes, was the kind of blueprint associated with a large layout in the space, so quickly, just struck me that the emotional investment that Lionel has, the ability, I guess, to distance oneself from that emotional investment and see the potential for the future. And I don't know how I caveat this, and I'm going to be very careful about how I say this. But when we've talked previously, my interpretation was that you were actually considerably older than you appear in front of me on Skype. I don't know how I came. I guess you had a lot of wisdom in the stuff that you were saying. But now I see your Facebook, your photo on Skype. I appreciate you also have a lot of time left to build another layout, potentially another layout following. So yeah, I had kind of misframed you, Mike. I assumed that you were coming into a kind of, either you were retired or you were, post-retirement. But now I see you, I get a sense that you actually have a lot of time left to build the perfect layout in, this new framing.
Well, that's part of the reason why I made the evaluation too. One of the things I said was, and Tom, I'm going to thank you because I have 12 grandchildren. So thank you very much.
Matt Goodman is another guy. I spent a day with Matt Goodman. He seems, youthful is an amazing, I don't know whether it's something, I think people that have hobbies tend to be considerably more youthful than people that don't have hobbies in these
circumstances. I would agree. Yeah. I would agree.
Anyway, moving on from the flattery.
So anyway, when I designed the Colorado and Coyote Creek, I was in my 30s. Yeah. I built it in my 40s. And now that I'm 50 years old, I stand there and I bend underneath the layout and I go, I don't want to do this for another 10 more years.
Yeah.
This is insanity. So that's been a lot of the changes that mm-hmm. went into it. We raised the layout so that the lowest point is 51 inches. Well, I can sit in a chair and look up and to be doing wiring and not have to bend under any layouts whatsoever.
It's an important point. Yeah. So in terms of what you've learned, you know, you've got 20 years plus worth of actual hands-on knowledge here. Plus you've got John.
Yes.
My assumption is, my sense might be, looking at historically people that I've talked with previously on the show, you are probably going to build this layout considerably faster because of all the knowledge that you've gathered than you would have done 30, 20 odd years ago.
Well, certainly that's...
What are the plans?
Well, the plants have been, it's been kind of interesting because like, I was looking at Andy's fine job of all his woodwork that he's doing. And I look at it and go, yeah, I've been there before. I'm not doing nearly as much woodwork.
Yes.
I mean, it's beautiful and I'm amazed by it and credit to Andy, but, wow, that is a ton of woodwork to
do. I think he's actually a fetishist. My view is that he takes it to such an extreme, and there are people in this hobby like that. Andy clearly loves his wood. There's no shortage of possibilities. When he did the stringer and put so much reinforcing around it, I mean, literally, I don't want to try it, but I can imagine actually stepping on that and not seeing a lot of bow in it, even though it's 7-foot-odd long.
Well, yeah. And that's part of what I've kind of considered. When I originally built the Colorado and Coyote Creek, I had one of my sons was building a house and his best friend were. So I had a mess of 2x6s sitting around. So I just kind of was like, well, why waste wood?
Yeah.
But this time I think looking at it from a framing standpoint, we're going to be very simple. Just simply building boxes of half walls that are out of 1x4 just to support at like an L girder type thing. And this simply just, I've gotten to the point now where I have a table saw on. It's much more easier to take, good quality plywood and cut it into 1x4s from that because it just doesn't, it just holds better than the 1x4s and just build out of that. It's lighter weight. And also I'm only trying to support a model train.
Yeah.
Not myself.
Certainly.
So it's more of an around the shelf type layout this time, and I think it'll be really good. The additional thing is, I don't know, maybe some folks remember back in the 90s, there was a gentleman at Model Railroader by the name of Paul Schmidt, who was an editor there.
Mm-hmm.
And Paul Schmidt is actually a friend of mine. I knew him before he went to Model Railroader. He left Model Railroader, came back out here. Mm-hmm. He now works for the Burlington Santa Fe Railroad as a signal maintainer.
Gosh.
And I talked to Paul the other day. We were talking about the layout, and he sent me an email saying, hey, Mike, I'd love to do the signals for you.
Yeah.
And I said, absolutely, not even a question. We'll have you in. So it's been very good, and it's been interesting to see it. Also, for those people who are looking for fellow model railroaders, I went to a model railroad hobbyist, and they actually have a map of where all their subscribers are at.
That's the missing step here. Yes.
And I basically sent emails out to all the folks that were nearby me, said, look, I'm going to send an email out to you. If you don't respond, I will never bother you again. But this is what I'm doing. Here's the website. Please let me know if you're interested. And didn't get many responses, but I got a few. And so we'll see what comes out of it. New layout was going. We'll prep the walls. And probably have bench work done. Look, we tore the layout down in 3 weeks. We'll probably have bench work up in about 6 weeks.
3 weeks, ladies and gentlemen. 3 weeks.
And that's an 800 square foot layout.
So for folks who are similarly considering what you're doing currently, did you have like a skip that you were just moving stuff into? Did you have someone that was interested in certain sections of the layout? Obviously, you were keeping some sections of the layout. How did you achieve the removal speed?
Well,
3 weeks? Tom, can I make a comment real quick?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, baby. That's how you get it done.
That's, yeah, that's absolutely true, James. And it is once I had kind of put in my mind, okay, this layout's coming down. I did take some final photographs, and I think I posted a few of them that were out there, and just simply said, okay, this needs to come down. And I've got a pile sitting outside of the railroad shop right now, that's probably about 3 or 4 feet by 6 feet by 3 feet high, ready to go to the dump when it's all mountains. Mm-hmm. And the lumber we pulled off, the track we pulled off, and the trees, I saved some of the best, and I said to the rest of them, it's got to go. We're starting again. And just accept it and just be encouraged by it.
I've recorded a lot of these shows. I'm rarely speechless. I think, yeah, that is just phenomenal. Like, that is just absolutely phenomenal. In terms of advice, obviously Lionel is partway there in terms of convincing you to do this. What advice would you give to other people that have invested, you know, 20 plus years in a layout where, as you say, it's a circumstance where if the hobby isn't fun anymore, you know, if they're in that mindset now, what advice would you give them to do this kind of radical thing?
Well, just like I had to do, you know, when facing a move, I was forced to look at the layout very critically and decide what I enjoyed and what was good and what wasn't. And as you begin to go through that process and you begin to put the list up of what you enjoyed and what you didn't enjoy, and then go through the process of designing the new layout, it's amazing how encouraged. I mean, we all love, I mean, what is it? We call this a hobby of tinkerers.
Yeah.
And that's what you begin. You begin to tinker with that plan and that layout and go, okay, what did I like? What didn't I like? What was fun to build and what was just absolutely painful to build?
Yeah.
And from that, you begin to lay out the new plan. And before too long, all of a sudden, you're done. And you find encouragement in, I'm involved in this hobby because of the joy of building it. And next thing you know, you're there and you're building it and you're encouraged to do it. So it becomes really quick when you're not, and you want to build it when you set down and figure out what it is. And I think Lionel, in his own mind, he said the same thing. I mean, he said, well, I'd probably do it again. It would be much smaller. Yeah. Well, then that's what you do.
Yeah.
You know, there's no rule just because you have all the space. And Tom, you're going to find this out with your own basement.
Amen.
You know, you're going to go, well, how much, it's not how much space do I have? How much time do I want to spend on maintenance or taking care of it?
Exactly. Yeah.
That really becomes the question. And, I mean, I look at Tony Custard. I mean, the Midland being tore down, I was stunned.
Yeah.
But I've got to say, Tony's new layout is, and I'm doing exactly what Tony did. He looked at his layout. He built it the same way I built the Colorado and Coyote Creek. And now his new layout is built exactly for what you want to be when you're 60 and pushing your way up. And I said, that's what I need to do too.
Yeah.
And that's how we stay young and keep going.
Describe the next 6 weeks to me. How are you going to get this thing done in 6 weeks?
Today, and I'd like to thank Jimmy Lowe for having an early start, because that means I get to get on the show and then turn around and head out to the shop. The piles are all separated. We'll begin to clean it up. Mm-hmm. We'll take the walls. We'll repaint them, reprep them, patch them up. And then once that's done, we'll start framing just the basic frame that'll be about 48 inches off the floor and begin framing that and starting the bench work. Now, I'm using the original staging guard that I had on the Colorado and Coyote Creek. So the first thing I have to do is raise that about 6 inches. Mm-hmm. And that will be done relatively simple. But after that, it's just a matter of building the framework and then starting to lay out the new benchwork for the tabletop that will go on. I'm going to be doing open grid work for the most part, and spline wherever there's single track or dual track area and no real turnouts. And then wherever we hit a yard or something like that, we'll go back to plywood again and homosode. And then just away we go. I mean, the new layout has 103 hand-laid turnouts this time.
Mm.
And for anyone like James and Tony all knows, to me, building hand-laid turnouts with fast tracks is probably some of the most enjoyable time I spend in model railroading, listening to you know, this show or any of the other podcasts that are out there on model railroading. And it's just enjoyable to sit down and just tinker away at it. And next thing you know, it's done.
Mm.
So, and they take about an hour a piece. So you're talking 103 hours of work.
Mm. It's interesting, actually, that you're choosing to optimize, or you're choosing to optimize certain aspects of the hobby, but choosing to put in, to add, allow for the time of the parts of the hobby that you enjoy doing that you know will take a set amount of time.
Well, you have to. Yeah. And it's a tinker's hobby. And I've worked with manufacturer turnouts, nothing wrong with them.
Mm-hmm.
But boy, the hand laid turnouts turn out so nice and so smooth and so enjoyable. And to be able to change the geometry to fit your need at that time is just, you know, when you're laying them out, is just phenomenal. I use a CAD program called AnyRail, and that basically allows me to sit down and draw out not only the layout, the bench work, the wiring. John, his first thought was, okay, so do we have a wiring plan? And I said, here it is, John. And he's like, great, I know what to do, you know. So yes. Just having those things planned out ahead of time, taking the time to figure out, okay, where's the computer going? Where's the power sources going? So that those things that I hate, which any moderator pretty much hates wiring, except for John, it just works out perfect, because then you've got it all planned and you can focus on what you enjoy doing, which is laying track, doing scenery, and running trains.
Mike? As I said, I'm rarely speechless on this particular recording, but you have given a new blueprint to folks that have been in the hobby. And Lionel, obviously, is a motivating factor here as well. But the speed and, I don't necessarily want to use the term the emotional disconnection, because clearly it's all emotionally driven associated with what you're doing. But the fact that you can just say blank slate, past 20, 30 years, learning experience, now is the time to do stuff that I enjoy in the hobby. I'm speechless, Mike. And the thing that interests me as well is that you've done another thing that I try to advocate for in the hobby. You've reached out to people in your area based purely to their subscription to Model Railroad Hobbyist. And you are going to create a new community around this layout, this new layout, which may actually, you talk about the things that you like, there may be people out there who are either lone wolf or, you know, are part of various other clubs, or people that you've never known in your area in the hobby that will bring their own insights and contributions through this. Yeah, I'm speechless, Mike. I'm really fascinated to see how this thing comes together, because I think you've done so many new and interesting things, and I'm just looking forward to hearing more updates from you.
Well, we'll try to get it out there. The other thing, Tom, just talking to some of the folks also on YouTube videos and all that, I'm going to try and get some videos out to kind of just show what goes on. And I'm sure it'll be quite humorous to see John and mine interaction as I look at John and go, whoa, hero, you know, at 6'4", he is a bull in a china shop sometimes.
Yeah, comedic model rail videos, always well appreciated. If that's another niche that you can enter, Mike, do it.
I will. Thanks, Tom.
So I have a really small amount of time. I've got literally 7 minutes to talk to folks, because I promised my wife, as we have a contractor showing up, and I have so many folks on. Tony Ryan, do you have audio?
I unmute, I'm here.
We've just talked to Mike. I've got a very limited amount of time. You must be, because you've seen the old lab.
Mm-hmm.
And you've been inspired by the old lab. Can you compress in maybe 3 minutes or less your response associated with what's happened with Mike?
Well, I was stunned when he announced that he was tearing it down. To me, though, he's exactly right. You know, what Lionel said, if it's not fun and it's being a drag, ditch it. Go to something that you like. And that's pretty much what the hobby is. Or don't feel so tied into something that you've gotten built that you can't alter it, change it, hack out a section, you know, that is really not working for you, and do it. I'm even more inspired, and I'll be looking forward to see what his new layout turns out to be as he goes along.
He's also done something really, and I keep returning to this, he smoked out local model railroaders that you've probably never known about. He's going to bring these people into his layout. You're going to meet these people as well. Can you talk about that as an idea?
Very cool. I think there's, you know, the splintering of model railroaders, whether it's by gauge or by locale or whatever, is a lot that you had to do with this thing. Model Railroad Hobbyist, you know, the Scotty Mason podcast and all that. Getting more exposure, getting people who are vocal about their hobby, you know, get it out of the closet, march it around a little bit, see who joins into the beat. I love it.
As I have very limited time left, I wanted to send two shout-outs in particular. The two other, you know, phenomenally large, long-living podcasts. Scotty Mason just celebrated 7 years recently. Hats off to him and the crew. I think we've had almost everyone on the Scotty Mason show on Model Rail Radio. I think we have had everyone on Scotty Mason. Oh, we haven't had the original cast, but we've had on Dave Frarian. He represents a number of folk. Congratulations to those folk. I also recently, and this was my first time on the Model Railcast show, appeared on the 200th episode of the Model Railcast show. That's not yet out. I'm not sure whether we'll get this show out first before they get out. I don't know. It was just like at the end of a long work day. I'm not sure what I said, but it will be captured no doubt in that audio. Hats off to those folk as well, to Ryan, who's appeared on my show. He was on the first Dave Frary show, and to Tim and obviously Craig Biscayer and the whole crew over there. Yeah, hats off to those guys. Tony, this is a shorter show than usual. We've got time constraints. The next show will have time constraints as well. However, I don't think we've actually lost anything. And the curious thing is, in framing this show, I feel like I've basically taken 5 hours worth of information and just condensed it down into probably a half-length show from that. So much amazing stuff. I mean, hats off to Jimmy Lowe in particular for calling this show, because we've gotten a wide variety of new content. Will Merrill stuff, I think, I don't know if Dave Falkenberg is still on, but folks need to look at this stuff as just the blueprint of how, and going to Mike's point, how to keep the hobby fun. If you're spending all your time setting up for a show and it's causing a wide variety of stress and headaches and, you know, the layouts just aren't quite fitting together, but you're basically blazing on because, you know, modular end scale is the way that the hobby's going to be converted. Spend a bit of time. Listen to it a few times. I think Will provided so much information in just that little quantity of space that people will need to listen to that section of the podcast again and again. If they're in end scale modular, I know you're in that frame of mind as well. Tony, did you hear all of Will's audio?
No,
or did you just catch half?
I got on late. I didn't hear any of it. So
you're
going
to have to
anxious.
Definitely go back and listen, because I think I've got to apologize here to Will again. We get on a lot of callers that are part of N-Scale Module groups. When I get them on, I like to talk to them in depth. When Will first called in, I don't know whether I didn't have a lot of time. I don't know what frame my mind was in, but I just lost that wisdom when Will was initially on. Today, for whatever reason, I was able to extract some of that wisdom. The next time Will calls in, my hope is this will generate a discussion. We'll get more questions to Will, because when I find people that are doing things really right in the hobby, that have had a long period of time doing them, I feel obligated to bring out their audio to the widest possible audience. Tony, I'm getting the wrap-up call here. Well, I've got to move a bunch of tomato seedlings and then go and meet with a contractor and then take some photos of the basement and then provide a wide variety of paint. I'd like to thank everyone for participating in today's show. Definitely more European-friendly times. Definitely Jimmy Lowe can exercise his assertions regularly. And I'd like to
thank you very much, Tom.
The folks for listening in as well. Good morning.
Good morning, Tom. Thank you.
Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Paul.
Good morning.
Good evening.